into getting HF, and do you know how reliable or easy the kids start to build for HF radios? Or do you suggest, like, buying a new one or trying to restore them? Because I don't know much about restoring. So, I don't know. What would you suggest to do to get into HF?
Have ham fist. All around, that is sort of like going to a flea market where it's nothing but radio equipment or computer equipment. And you need to take someone like Russell or another ham with you. And to start with, I would start off with a good used HF radio that, I bought an ICOM 751 at the Shelby Ham Fest for $200, and it covered 160 through 10 meters. Had its own built-in power supply and everything. And Heathkit used to, it was a company out of Benton Harbor, Michigan, that the only HF radios they sold to start with was in a kit form where you built them. That's how I got it. My first HF radio was a heat kit. Now, I've got one sitting here on the bench now I'm waiting on parts for. But then I think finally before they went out of business, they would sell the kit or you could either order it factory built. But if you go buy a new HF radio, man, you're going to start off at about anywhere $6,000 to $1,000. And I know for a 13-year-old, you ain't got that kind of money. But you can go to a ham fest, Brawler's, that owns this repeater here. We had to cancel ours the last 2 years, no, last year on account of the virus. But it will be sometime at the beginning of spring this year. They haven't set the date yet, but they just had one in Anderson. Let's see, 2 weeks ago they had one over here in Gaffney. A week before that, they had one in Anderson. And then they had the big one up in Shelby, North Carolina, Labor Day. And they had one just a few weeks ago in Rock Hill. And they all around, but that would be the best way to go with your first HF radio is to get an older ham that's been into it for a while to go to a ham fest. Or either like on Wednesday night when KI4DOS, Gary has the swap net on this repeater. He's got a lot of equipment on there from what we call silent keys. That's operators that have passed away and their wives are selling all the radio equipment off and all. And Gary would be a good guy to talk to about a good, he is as honest as the day comes, and he'd be a good guy to talk to about a used HF radio, Alexander.
So that thing that they call, told, is it hand fits or fists or what? Flea market place, you know, where they have, like, all the ham radios. What is it called? Ham fist?
Ham fist. Ham fist. F-E-S-T. Like having a big dinner, a big fest to eat Thanksgiving. But this year, instead of eating dinner, you're eating up the bargains you get in radio equipment.
To go, so this is K-O-4-U-L-P, and I'll be clear after your final. Nice talking to you, Walt, 73.
L-P, K-4-O-I-M. Alexander, you wouldn't believe this. But I've been calling the net on Tuesday night now for, I think, about 10, 11 months now. And before that, I was scared to death of a microphone. The only time I got on the radio was with Morse code. And I'm proud of you for just jumping right in there and grabbing that mic and going with it. So with that, Alexander, I'll say 7, please, and I'll be listening for you. K-O-4-U-L-P, K-4-O-I-M. 7-3's, Alexander, K-4-O-I-M. I'll be clear of the monitoring.
CLX, I'm back.
CLX, W4DJW, again. Just like yesterday, huh?
WN6CLX. Hey, Dick. Yeah, I'm out of breath. Left work early so I could get over here to the pharmacy. I missed the pharmacy. And I'm heck on vehicles this week. I picked up something that destroyed one of my tires, I guess.
With the flat? Or are you going again now after getting it fixed?
Put on the donut. Luckily, I was able to get someplace before I rode on the bead. But I rolled the tire around, and man, I don't know if I can repair this one. Yeah, I mean, it just looks like it's cut right across the tread.
Good. Two down. You got a third one to go?
Tomorrow. I've got... I bought these tires 4 years ago, and I bought the road hazard from Goodyear, so I'll get some kind of warranty out of it. But, yeah, I've got a third vehicle. Unfortunately, it's a 30-foot motorhome.
Difficult to get around town then. I was thinking you were going to say motorcycle, just when it turned cold. it wouldn't be any fun on a motorcycle either.
But I'm about to switch to an electric scooter.
Work pretty good, and they hold up pretty well, all things considered. I used to have a scooter. I lived out in the country, and it was kind of fun moving around, not having to get the car just when you're going down the road, just to 3 or 4 houses.
Action at work before I left. I was saying maybe I need to just get a moped, but driving up the other side of Spartanburg from Greenville County on a moped.
The other direction. Maybe you just need a multirotor that you just sit on and ride, and it cruises about 120. You just rise above all of this mess, and you press the go button and lean forward, and in about 10 minutes, you're home.
Let's say it. N6CLX will keep up with that ID. Man, I tell you what. It's looking like a better and better idea until... all of us fools get those things, and then we have mid-air collisions.
Something different. It's just, I've been used to working from home for the past, 15 years. I don't get out much. And when I do get it, now that I'm not working, well, I work my own hour, I do what I want now. But I'm going out after work, whereas I used to not do that, because work went all the way up to nighttime, right? 6 o'clock Pacific time. Is 9 o'clock our time, so, and it's pitch dark outside. May as well, it's not worth the effort. But we gotta get away from this two-dimensional travel. We've pushed it to its limit. As you well know, when you go between San Diego and L.A., any time of the day over in California, that ought to be a hour trip at the most, and it's like 4 hours.
Yeah. I've got my pilot's license, my private pilot's license. I just haven't done it since 2009. And frankly, it just plain started scaring the crap out of me. Plus, it got expensive.
Well, it's now they're going to make that a whole lot nicer, a whole lot more stable, have a lot more confidence. Things will work a whole lot better.
I would agree with you, but I've had my experience of malfunctioning equipment.
On that too, quadruple redundancy on flight controllers. Not autopilots like you would think of, like they use on a commercial airplane. Autopilots that make it really simple, make it so that you can fly an airplane like you ride a motorcycle.
That's going to make it too expensive for anyone but the ultra-rich people. That component is the U.S. government and the FAA.
And that's true, but after they pay for all the research, then the price comes down to something that everybody else can afford. So, yeah, there is, and they're the ones that, you know, do all the all the dangerous testing.
If my plan comes to fruition, I've got 8 years of this test left, and I'm just going to call it quits and say I can't take it anymore.
Plan? That's about where I am now, except I've set, playing around in the market, if you call that work.
Can you eat the advisors for it? Just let them have it. I don't feel like trying to time the market. I don't feel like trying to watch the market. I don't even care if it goes up or down, just because it's all a short term. Anyway, you know, I'm still in a kind of a quasi medium term here. Just making it fun.
Stay with you at the beginning. Go ahead, Chad.
Felix and W4DJW, didn't mean to interrupt your conversation, gentlemen. But, Dave, when you got a second, I got a couple of airplane questions for you.
Go ahead. I got time now.
Oh, Lord, I better just sign now. I'll never get another word in. N6CLX.
Ahead.
Even airplane questions. He'll load you up, Chad, N6CLX. I'm going to clear out. Glad to have you back safely, Chad. I heard you coming in from Normandy. Talk to you later, N6CLX. I'm quick.
So, Dave, on the flight to France, I don't know what kind of airplane it was, but it's the first airplane I've ever sat in that had a computer in the seat back in front of you. So you could watch movies and you do all this other stuff, but you could also view some of the flight data that I guess the airplane was experiencing. And I just been waiting to get you on the air to ask you, or some of these numbers that I was seeing, are these numbers correct? So the first number was, on the way to France, we had a tailwind. The data screen showed a tailwind of 151 miles per hour. Is that correct?
No, the jet stream. The jet stream on the way over there makes the flight shorter. On the way back, it can make the flight longer. And it can be a whole lot more than 150 miles an hour. It can be 300 or 400 miles an hour. So it can make an extremely short trip, or if you're coming back from over there, it can make it an extremely long trip. But, yeah, the jet stream goes really, really fast.
That's right. So this is not some kind of aeronautical term trick. That is actual wind speed. If the jet stream would drop down to the surface of the earth and I was standing on the ground, that wind was actually moving 151 miles per hour. Is that correct?
That's affirmative, and that's slow for the jet stream. That is very slow for the jet stream. It can go significantly faster than that.
If I've made a connection here then, not knowing that much about airplanes, up at that altitude, that's where they make money. Is that correct?
Well, that's the pilot's job, is to find an altitude that he's got the strongest tailwind that is not turbulent. So you got to keep the passengers happy. You can't be, you know, going up and down by 30 feet every 1.5 seconds, right? The passengers are not going to like that at all. So, but he will go through air like that to find smooth air, but at the same time, the best tailwind he can find, or the least headwind he can find. And that way he conserves energy and gets you there on time.
So So they do use it to, I guess, the more efficient the plane, then obviously the more fuel conserved, which means, you know, more money, correct?
That's true. But in the grand scheme of things, that's not the big money saver. getting fully occupied airplanes and having flights, you know, that are consistent over time is their big money earner. That's a factor, but that's not the big factor.
I got you. I wasn't trying to insinuate that. I was just thinking, you know, if the wind's pushing the airplane at 151 miles an hour, then it's not working near as hard to get to the destination, which means they're saving on fuel and whatnot. So I get it. Okay, so second question. Minus 61 degrees. Is that correct?
Up there. It is super cold. And it's not that the plane is working any harder or less hard. The plane's working the same amount of work it would work if there wasn't a headwind or a tailwind. It's working just as hard regardless of what the wind is doing. It's just it's going to do it longer, or it's going to do it for a shorter period of time or for a longer period of time. That's the only difference. The work that it has to do to fly, the airspeed that it has to fly, is no different coming or going, headwind or tailwind. Right, it's the same. It's just how long does it have to do that the headwind and the tailwind cause. And yes, it is super cold out there. When you get out all the way to outer space, it's like three times colder than that.
Does the temperature of the air affect the efficiency of how the jet engine works? I am assuming, being a diesel guy, that you can get a little bit more efficiency and a little bit more horsepower if the air that enters the intake, now this is a piston engine, of course, you can get a little more horsepower and efficiency the cooler the air, because air's, you know, colder it is, more condensed it is. But I'm not too familiar with the jet engine. I do know it compresses air and fuel somehow with fins and this, that, and the other. But does the temperature affect the efficiency, I guess? In other words, would it be less efficient in hot weather than in cold weather?
And the answer is yes, but it's not the only thing that affects it. The air density as you go up, the space between the air molecules increases as you go higher in altitude. As you go down in temperature, they compact more. So two things are happening. You're going higher and they're getting looser, and you're getting colder and they're getting tighter, right? So the two things offset each other. But the denser, the more air molecules you can get in there to mix with your fuel, you're looking for an ideal mixture, an air-to-fuel mixture. And you can get too thin of air, and you can get too dense of air compared to your number of molecules of fuel that you have. So the goal is to get the air mixture and the fuel mixture at the top of the power curve. And you can change, you have control over how much air you let in and how much fuel you inject. So the answer to your question is yes. There's an optimal, and they try to keep it right there on the power curve as much as possible, regardless of how high you are or how cold it is outside.
All right, so last thing's not a question, but just want to let you know, I went through the Overlord Museum there in Normandy, and oh my goodness, the equipment they had in there, just, you know, tanks and this and that were just, you know, just shot all to pieces. But I took some video and some pretty interesting pictures of some, I don't know why I thought of you, but I just was standing there looking at these airplane engines that were just shot all to pieces. I mean, just horrible looking things that they either crashed on the beach or recovered out of the Utah or Omaha Beach area, and portions of the airplane too. But I've got three, not that you're interested, but if you are, three airplane engines that they had there in the museum. All three different engines, 16 cylinder. One of them was, two of them was in kind of like a V8 in line, but the other one was 16 cylinder, looked like a radial. I'm not familiar with radials, but it just 16 cylinders stuck out of a round drum that looked a little bit bigger than a 5 gallon bucket. But just shot all two pieces. I just thought you'd be interested. I'm gonna put the videos up on YouTube here in a couple of days. But they're just an amazing thing. I'd see how they fly those things there. My goodness, big engines. I never thought that an airplane engine could be that big. Piston driven and still move the airplane.
W4DJW. That is amazing. I've watched a lot of World War II videos of airplanes. You know, the Bearcat came out right at the end of the war, and the Bearcat had one of the most powerful engines. And some of those airplanes, they could shoot their bullets and they'd go into a power dive and they'd be shooting at the guy in front of them. And the airplane was so powerful, it could outrun its own bullets. And when it could go under the bullets, it could pass them. It's as it's diving down, it could pass the bullets that it fired a few seconds ago. And then when the pilot pulled up, the bullets that when you pull up, it slows the airplane down. When you pull up, it slows down and the bullets come in. And he shot himself. he delivered the bullet a few seconds ago. He flew past the bullet. He pulled up and the bullet ran into him. That happens. I also saw bombers that had the enemy airplane that just crashed into the bomber, and the wing cut the fuselage right in front of the rudder, almost in two, but not quite. And so the guy in the back carriage, he couldn't get out because if he did, he provided ballast to keep the airplane flying, to keep the weight on it so that it wouldn't flap, because the whole tail would start flapping when he tried to get out and go forward. So his crewmates tied the fuselage back together where the rudder comes up, right, back to the fuselage where the wing made a slice through it, and they tied it back together and flew the thing all the way home and landed. There are some incredible stories. You can watch videos for hours on that kind of stuff. It's really, really interesting. I'm glad you got to experience that and made it back safely with all the coronavirus stuff going on. But I'm glad you got to experience that. I could get carried away, like Mike was saying, and talk for hours on that, so I'll try to restrain myself a little bit. W4DJW.
Took the flight. Had a window seat on. I didn't know what kind of airplane it was. It was a newer airplane, United. Commercial, of course. But so on the wing, on the front of the wing, you have this curve, and that helps create the lift, and then. As you go across the top of the wing, that wing creates a low and high pressure, which creates a lift, angle of attack. I get some of that. But the control surface is on the back side of the wing, so the air lifts, comes over the wing, and then you have these flaps, or rudder, not rudders, but flap-looking things at the edge of the wing that may be an aileron. I don't know anything about airplane parts, but this was the first aircraft that I have ever seen that had a flap-looking thing at the end of the wing. And by the end, I mean it's hard to explain. The air comes over the top and exits over the top, and then you have these surfaces that move up and down, flap-looking things. Not sure what they do, but this aircraft had an additional set of flaps buried in the wing in front of the rear flappy things. But they would raise up, and the only way I know how to explain it, and I'm not saying it was a rug, because I know that cloth surface is not going to perform at that altitude or anything. But as this flap raised, it looked like a rug that was under it that moved. As the flap came up, the rug would extend out over the top of the wing surface. When the flap came down, it would retract with that flap surface. And, it's just hard to explain. I'm not sure I can explain it, really. Maybe it's some kind of drag or something. But I've never seen two sets of flaps on a wing like that, one in the wing and one at the edge of the wing. You know anything about that?
I am only one car away from my first window of two, so if I disappear, you'll know what happened to me. But the goal is, as the airplane changes speed, to maintain optimal lift and drag as it goes faster. So when you get up in the air, you want to get all clean and wings swept back and not much drag. But when you're coming in for a landing, you want to get all dirty. So the ideal way to do that is if you had liquid metal wings and you could shape them exactly the way you wanted to shape them, but liquid metal doesn't exist yet. or not in a form that you can make wings out of. So they do all kinds of things to have trim tabs and flaps, flaperons close to the fuselage, wingtip, rudders. There's just tons and tons of things that they're constantly doing. So what you're seeing is not unusual, right? To have multiple stages of flaps that come down, like four stages of flaps, and they actually curve. And it's not just the old mechanical two straight lines, a straight line that's the bottom of the wing, a straight line that's the flap. That's clunky. That's old school clunky. New school is they've got like six lines, and it just rounds it off the way it would be if it was liquid. And it's my turn at the window, so I'll be back in a minute. W4DJW.
L-E in your old TR.
Go ahead, Tom.
And I thought you was an Airedale, but you just aren't. You're one of them foxhole guys. Anyways, the front ones on the front of the wings are slats. And then your ailerons are out towards the wingtip there, Chad. And by the way, for example, a 787, if I remember rightly, is about 40% more fuel efficient than the old 757. And most likely, you were on a 777 or a 787. A 787 is almost totally a composite body chin, and that's what my nephew flies. But I remember in the big four-engine turboprop that I flew in, this is Gerald TR. When we were going overseas out towards Midway and Wake, of course, we knew we was going to be flying against the jet stream. They know what time of year, which direction it's going to be in. And that plane would fly 360 knots or about 400 miles an hour top speed. And we were lucky to be making 225 miles an hour in that headwind, Chet.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to mention what the airspeed was displaying on the thing in front of me. I was afraid he wouldn't believe me. But if I remember correctly, the highest speed I remember seeing on the aircraft on those little displays was about 620 miles an hour. But like I said, I didn't want to say that out loud because that seemed kind of fast to me.
No, not at all. The 787, I think, in the 777 is about 0.95 Mach. And that's under Mach 1.95. and the older ones are quite a bit less than that. And these small ones, like out of Greenville that you fly to Detroit on and that, they fly about 500 miles an hour, 4-something, 5-something, in that area, depending on the winds. But jets on the ground, Chad, like in a terrible summertime heat, I've seen them shut down airports because they have a limit at which they will take off in. If that temperature gets beyond that, which, I don't know, 120 or so out there in Arizona, they'll ground the airplanes. They eat fuel when they're sitting there. If you get in a big line of planes on the tarmac, a lot of times they fill those planes just to make their trip, plus, 3 hours or something. There's a safety margin they have to have in there. But they'll ground them. And jets are one of the most efficient machines in the world and most reliable. I didn't mean efficient, but most reliable machines in the world. I think the only thing that even comes close is a transformer. But they are very reliable. And they love being in the cold air.
The other thing that I noticed was when we landed at Charles de Gaulle, learned my lesson here, and I learned, kind of realized to kind of why C-130s don't have a lot of windows. That might be so the soldiers can't see outside, I guess. But I was sitting near the window at the back of the plane, and I was able to see out of the peripheral in my left eye. I could see the white lines on the tarmac painted traffic lines on a highway. And I noticed immediately when we landed, with, I guess, the vision in both eyes, that the center of the airplane from the inside was not anywhere near being parallel to the white line out on the tarmac. In other words, it was like the airplane landed crooked. And man, when he hit the tarmac, the front of that aircraft had not hit the ground, but the wheels under the wings had hit the ground. I mean, the front of that aircraft just shot over to the right, probably 5 to 7 degrees, just, real quick. I mean, it was horrible looking when you've got the white line on the tarmac to compare it to.
Crabbing into the wind, Chad, if they got a crosswind and they have a maximum and it's around approximately 40 miles an hour for a big jet usually, and they'll put the airplane kind of Sigonal to the, in other words, the nose of the aircraft might be going to the left of the runway before you touch down, and they, of course, touch down on the landing gear, but then when they finally touch the nose wheel, they jam that rudder fully in the other direction and straighten it out. I saw an A380, which is the biggest Airbus they make, that can carry, 500-600 passengers. We were at Oshkosh when the first one that come to the States landed, and Bernice and I were standing by the runway, and it was a short runway, and they had a real high crosswind that day, up in the 30s, upper 30s. And he landed exactly like that, and then he slammed that rudder fully in the other direction and reversed those engines instantaneously. Anyways, maybe Dave got his chow by now, W4DJW in 0GR.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm just listening, but yeah, carry on. that's good information. But yeah, Chad, those pilots, that's how they earn their money. They do that every day, day in and day out. To them, it just becomes boring after a while. But that's what they do to earn a living. It seems like it would be fun, but I think after a while it gets boring. Anyway, over to you, Chad, W4DJW.
I've been on commercial aircraft before. I've spent a lot of time on the military stuff as a passenger and all. But I gotta be honest with you. This was a relatively new aircraft. I don't know what it was. I should have paid attention to that, I guess. But, man, it was clean. I don't mean clean as in clean and dirty. I mean, it had clean lines. I was able to watch and see what was happening with the wing and all the control surfaces on the wing while we were flying. And as far as I could tell, you know, I'm pretty good at detecting a little bit of movement with my eyes, you know, I don't know, probably down to a quarter, eighth of an inch, I guess. But I could see in flight that the control surface was just minutely moving. I mean, it would look like it would raise maybe an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch, and then a couple of seconds later, it dropped back down to normal. And when we landed, those flaps looked like they came all the way up and opened up like a clamshell. And I could see all of the control items inside there. It looked like hydraulic cylinders and cables and all these wires and connectors and this, that, and the other. And, I mean, I'm not a pilot or anything like that, but it was a nice flight. And, I mean, the airplane was really comfortable. Not the seats, but just how it flew and the way it sounded. But like I said, I've spent a lot of time in C-130s, which are really loud. But this thing was, we got on the thing at Greenville Spartanburg to take off, and I thought to myself, man, this thing is sluggish, you know, out on the taxi. But man, when he hit the juice, it was, I swear it felt like it was like 50 feet and we were off the ground. It was that quick. And I was kind of impressed with that. It was kind of neat.
I always time them, Chan, and for the most part, about 40 seconds, and they pull up at about, 2,500 foot a second, if you listen to them, down there at GSP. Air traffic will send them up to 10,000, and they'll tell them to contact Atlanta Center, and then Atlanta Center sends them on up to whatever they're going to. But usually about 36 or 38,000 is normally as far up as they go. And those engines on those things can have as much as a little over 100,000 pounds of thrust now. To give you an example, the old 727s, back earlier, those three engine jobs, they'd have 20,000 pounds of thrust. KO4LAO can really tell you about it. He piloted the DC-10 version of a fueler tanker and the 707 version, KC-135. So he's a lot smarter than I am, for sure. And so is Dave, for that matter. Because Dave's piloted the small ones. But if you go above those levels, and they're capable of getting up near 50,000 now with the newer planes. The pilot and co-pilot has to have on oxygen at all times, and so they don't normally do that. But I was trying to think of some of the other things. You mentioned the actuators. This is Gerald TR. The 777, the 787, and a lot of the Airbuses now are fly-by-wire, Chad, and they don't have a lot of those hydraulic actuators that the old ones have. They have electronic servo motors, or electrical servo motors, that do the same thing. And like I said, that tube that the 787's made out of is composite. Sort of like fiberglass, but it's not. A lot stronger. A normal jet has so many cycles of where you pressurize and depressurize, and then they take them out of service after, let's say, 20, 25 years. A composite aircraft, they can fly forever, basically, as long as the maintenance is done on them, because Every time you pressurize that jet, that skin expands and contracts, and it's riveted together, whereas there are no rivets on a composite. And you mentioned not having any windows on the C-130 and that. Windows are a source of drag. So the less drag you have, the more speed you got. W4DJW and 0TR.
Chad, you're very observant. Most people don't, they look at that and they don't see the detail that you saw. So that's good that you were that observant. Of course, you've worked around lathes and milling machines and stuff like that. One of the things that impressed me when I was out in San Diego, the USS Midway is parked out there, and they've got jets that are parked out on it. And I walked up to an F-16 that was parked on the deck, or either on the top or on the deck, one of the decks. And one of the things that a pilot instinctively does is you do a walk around the airplane and you move the control surfaces and you see how much slop there is in the hinges and those hydraulics and stuff that you were when I went up to that S-16, and you're talking about 15, 20, 30 feet out away from the airplane, and you should be able to wiggle an aileron up and down or an elevator, and their whole elevator moves up and down on the S-16. So you'd think there'd be some play. Absolutely no play whatsoever that a human can produce with all the muscle that you've got, right? You can't move that thing up or down. It's just solid as a rock. And that's when you're going 600 miles an hour, it needs to be solid as a rock. And it's just the mechanical aspect of how they do that, how they create something that has that much leverage, that far out, and you can't even budget a 16th of an inch. That's just like Tom was saying, that's just some mind-boggling engineering going on there. It's very, very easy to appreciate if you've ever been around mechanical, you know, manufacturing process. W4DJW, over to you, Chad.
I'll make sure I got it. So, yeah, I noticed that going from Greenville-Spartanburg, kind of watched the airplane, listened, and felt it, was really impressed. 4 days later, we end up at Utah Beach, and they've got a little museum there. But the only thing they had in it was I believe it was a Corsair, or was it a Vault something? I should have paid more attention to the names. But it looked like the airplanes were, the wings were bent, and the belly hung down under it. That's the only way I know how to explain it. But I'm going to tell you, that was the most beautiful airplane I think I have ever seen. It just looked like it was made to fly. And, you know, I could just, not to get all weird or anything, but you could see a little bit into the cockpit, and just simple. There were controls, I mean, there were gauges and things in there, but nothing like the jetliner. I mean, the commercial liner. I mean, it was a couple of gauges and some kind of stick, looks like, but, I mean, you could literally smell the airplane. It smelled like old greasy, oily leather, and, you know, just absolutely gorgeous. And I just sat there and looked at it, and I just thought, man, what a thrill it would be to just sit and fly in this thing, much less fly it. But it was just gorgeous, just beautiful airplane. And I just, you know, I like to say what a privilege it was to fly the things, but I probably would retract that statement, knowing what they were used for and where they were. But I just, you know, it was just, it was gorgeous. It really was.
It's Vought F4U, and that's a gull wing, Chad, and that's my very favorite airplane in this world. I've seen several of them up in Oshkosh, and pilots call those steam gauges now because they have all glass cockpits now. And Steve on the 787 just has four big, we'll call them digital displays. And they still keep a few of the things in most of them. I don't know about the 787. In case all that goes dead, you still got to have an altimeter, maybe a turning bank, and a rate of climb, and a magnetic compass. But as you were watching those wings and the little movements there, once they get off the ground and get up to altitude, they put that on autopilot. And I went through autopilot school down in Jacksonville. My gracious, the difference now in the comparison to the 60s, there's no comparison. And, you know, they're just awesome, and they have GPS that knows where they're at within a few miles. They have ADS-B that reports back now by satellite. So used to be, once they got out beyond radar range, they were on HF for the most part, and that wasn't always that reliable. But now they know where they're at all the time. Because of that plane that got lost down there in Indonesia, they got on all of them. They got another thing they call TCAS. So as they're going along, if another plane flies into their proximity, they get a warning, tells them to climb or dive, whichever's necessary to avoid the collision. They're just a plethora of things there that are wonderful. My uncle was in the Marine Corps, and he crashed at Cherry Point in an A-1 Sky Raider. I got to sit in one of those up in Kansas City at Richard Scobar Air Force Base when I was a little kid. You talk about impressionable. That was something. Anyways, go ahead, Dave. W4DJWN0TR.
The things that impresses me, I still can't fathom, is that in 1902, we didn't even know if man could fly. Right? We didn't. Nobody proved it until the Wright brothers actually got out there and did their little short pick your feet up while you're running and sit in the airplane for just. And you went from that to what we have, what we're talking about right now in less than 100 years. That's just mind boggling. What's it going to be like 100 years from now when each of us have our own, when we're flying individually like you would ride a motorcycle today? That's what's mind boggling. Where are we going from here? And there's some concept models of flying wings that house 500 people, and they're much more efficient and they're much faster than the planes that we're talking about now. The planes that we're talking about now will be old, right? There will be much more efficient ways of doing what we're talking about. That's just mind-boggling. It's good to see, but hard to fathom. W4DJW, over to you, Chad.
The last thing I noticed was I'm doing comparisons here from, you know, the stuff I flew on in Iraq, C-130s, C-17s, I think it was KC-145, KC-10, Sherpa, Black Hawks, Chinooks, things like that. And I get those are workhorses. I get that. But when we landed at both Charles de Gaulle and coming back home, this was a pretty big aircraft. And when that thing hit the ground, there was not a whole lot of braking going on as far as the wheels go. He did some braking. I could feel the actually rotors starting to heat up a little bit, or the drums, whichever one it was. But he was not on them long at all. And it was almost like I felt, it's kind of weird to explain, like a power shift moved through the airplane, which is kind of crazy sounding, I guess. So in other words, I felt the braking in one area, and then that harshness just went away, and I guess the engines took over. Not sure how that engine can reverse thrust that quick. But I guess if you don't have pistons and rods hanging on the end of it, you can pretty much do what you want. But my point is that it was less than, it seemed like 5 to 10 seconds, and the aircraft was just totally under control as far as, you know, all of that speed when it hit the tarmac was just feathered down to nothing very quickly and was very smooth. Nothing like what I can remember. I mean, you know, fully loaded C-130s, just harsh. I mean, it's just like, oh my gosh, is this thing gonna ever stop? But this was just unbelievable, just amazing. As far as power getting up, power stopping. And one thing that I did notice when I got off of the airplane, and haven't quite figured out what these were there for, but on the tires, where the rim fits into the tire, there was a protrusion built into the rubber, like a ridge, that went all the way around the tire. I don't know how, just other than a ridge or a projection, that projected out about 2 inches on the sidewall of the tire near the rim. I have no idea what that was. Maybe keep you from coming off the bead or something. But can you reverse that power that quick? Obviously you can. I guess he stopped it somehow.
They just reverse the direction of the thrust. They don't really reverse the engine, Chad. And they land at about 140 to 45 miles an hour normally, and they have a sink rate that they got to maintain on the way down, so many feet per minute. And they got to stay above that speed in order to land without stalling, I'm sure Dave could tell you. I don't know about the tire thing. But on the C-130s, they have T-56, and I don't know what the version is now. Ours were T-56 Alphas, and the C-130s have the same. They're about 4,600 shaft horsepower each. But the propeller's constant speed, and that's about a 13-foot, 9-inch propeller. So what they do is they control the amount of fuel to those engines and the amount of pitch on the blades, Chad, and then they reverse those when they land in order to stop it. And there are several different ways on the jet engines. Some of them you'll see the cowling raise up on the tail section of them, and it reverses it back. But basically, it's just pushing the wind in the other direction. But they still use braking, and they don't want a wheel fire. That can be bad. We used to simulate that when they had check pilots on our plane. They'd simulate a wheel fire. Everybody had to get out, and usually the young pilots would forget to depressurize the aircraft, and you cannot open an emergency exit or any other exit on a plane because of the pressure inside. So the crew was always dead if you forgot to depressurize. But, you'd be halfway down the runway and the test pilot would feather an engine or something, and the guy'd have to get stopped before he got to V1 or V2. I think it was V2, Dave could tell you. And it's interesting. But that engine, that looks like an automotive engine. One of the engines is an Allison, they're 12-cylinder, and my neighbor bought 6 of them, and they put one in a hot rod he's got, and he used the distributors out of a Jaguar, and he adapted them to that engine, and took the magneto out. And they also use them a lot still to this day in tractor pulls, Allison 12-cylinder engines. But the British, I can't remember the nomenclature on theirs, but they had a different one in their Spitfire, I think. And they were around 2,000 horsepower, as my old memory remembers now. Go ahead, Dave.
That reverse thrust isn't by changing the engine direction. That's by putting that cowling comes out from behind the engine, not in front of it. It's the back cowling. And it's just like a cup. They just put a cup behind it, and then the pilot pours the power on once he's got that on there, and the air blows forward instead of blowing backwards, and that's what stops the air. That's a major stopping of the it rumbles and shakes the whole airplane when he pours the power on after he has the cowling wrapped around. It depends on where you're sitting is whether you can see that when that happens. I've watched that. It's impressive when you see that scoop come out from around the side and go behind the engine, and then all of a sudden you're pushed up against the seatbelt. When your seatbelt's on, you're pushed up against the seatbelt because he poured the coals to the engine, and that redirected the thrust to the forward instead of backwards. But that is impressive. You get a sense of how small you are when you're in something like that, and you're feeling how much that thing weighs, and you're feeling that they're stopping that with mostly air, right? That's kind of that'll make you pause for a moment to think about what that air is doing. Anyway, I'm pulling in my neighborhood, so this is gonna be my last one. But anyway, I enjoyed it, and glad you guys had a good trip over there, and hopefully you're about caught up from your jet lag. But enjoyed it. I'm going to go inside and eat some Swoskies. Enzo TR and KO4NUE, W4DJW. This will be my last one.
Thank you, Dave. Have a nice evening, sir. Appreciate the QSO. Go ahead, Tom.
Good evening, Dave. 73. Say hi to Amy. Chad, it is impressive. The P-51 Mustang could dive at almost 500 miles an hour. The limitations of propeller, Chad, and that's why they had to go to jets, because they couldn't get beyond that until the Germans developed the jet engine. I think the Brits developed one just about the same time, but they're in World War II. But it is impressive what they can do. If you ever really want to get an eyeball full, go up there to Oshkosh in August, I think it is, and it's the most wonderful air show you'll ever see. The only one that compares to it's Paris. I just wondered if Paris had changed. When we went over there about 13 years ago, the airplane didn't taxi up to one of those extensions that come out, Chad, and they actually stopped on the tarmac like in the old days, and they brought out a ladder that you went down that set of stairways. Are they still that way?